March 23rd, 1971. Testimony by Mr. Levy and Mr. Lipton before this Joint Impact Committee on the Pipeline. Tape 3. That is number 3 in the series.
In Canada may well be faster than our own ones, because I believe they will have one minister in charge. I think the present Minister of Fisheries will be the man in Davis, I think will be put in charge of ecology. And I think he will take a more charitable view about Canadian fish than he will about Alaskan fish. And then the Energy Board is the one which will give the license under the minister. So that part may move reasonably fast. I do not believe that the oil companies are particularly enthusiastic to go via Canada as a group. They would, I believe, prefer a tap line. If you come in and say we want to be included, I'm sure that this might be a delaying factor, because it might be much more complicated to work that out. You have really two bases on which you, in my judgment, have an interest. The first one is as royalty owner. May take the position we want to be also a shipper from time to time. And secondly, as a state who is absolutely vitally interested in the netback of its oil to the wellhead on the one hand, and the amount of oil that is allowed to go through that line on the other hand, I think you probably want to have the nuisance value that a minority owner may have, and the information, and the right to know exactly what goes on internally. The right to go to Canada and kick as an owner rather than as a state which is can be ignored. Owners have more rights than states in certain situations.
Whenever the question of either timing or cost comes up with respect to the Canadian line, I'm always somewhat nonplussed, because what hangs in the balance is a possible 400 to 450 miles which connects Prudhoe with the Mackenzie. And so far as I know, very little work has yet been done as to the routing or the problems of that very, very vital link. Now, this will largely be in Alaskan terrain, and when we hear about the incompleteness of the ecological studies that have been done to date on the Alyeska route after all these years of study. I mean, what is yet involved? I have no idea. It may be very simple, but since it hasn't even been tackled or approached yet, there's bound to be a very considerable span of time before one can even begin to approximate the problems, the timing, or the cost of linking Prudhoe to the Mackenzie Delta, or the Mackenzie Valley if it comes appreciably south of the Delta, before the Canadians can even think of building their line down the Mackenzie River Valley to Edmonton.
In your view, what can we as a legislature, the executive branch of the government, citizens, anything else do to, if anything, to hasten the Prudhoe Valdez permit?
I think the first thing that would be very important, if it were possible for Canada to speak with one voice, I mean, in the executive, legislative, and through your senators, with one voice asking for...
You mean Alaska?
Alaska, yes. Secondly, make sure that if it goes via Canada, there are absolute minimum rights that have to be protected. And these minimum rights may be more than the Canadians are willing to give. I do not think anything should be done that would make the development of North Slope oil, either via Canada or via Valdez, more difficult. Because from every point of view, it serves your purpose, it serves everybody else's purpose to have this oil come out as soon as possible under as favorable conditions as could be obtained. One may have to, you may have to settle for the second best, I don't know. But even then you want it to come out as advantageously as possible.
Well, as I understood your earlier testimony, and I'm not going to review it, but it seems to me that insofar as the consideration of many of the legislators are concerned, you served the coup de grace to the Canadian route and I'll go through all the reasons if anybody wants to hear them, but I made notes on them as you went along, which seems to me to mean then that we ought to do whatever we can to accomplish the issuance of the permit for the Alaskan route. And some of us are somewhat frustrated as to what best to do in that arena to accomplish it at this time. That's not really a question.
No, I know.
Well, if that's not really a question, may I say something that's not really an answer?
You may not answer my non-question.
You know, it's not just the pipeline permit. It's the land question, the claims question, which also has to be settled. Because these things
are tied together. Morton made the statement now he wouldn't move without the Indian land settlement. And then you may have the problem that in the year 1972, the federal government may be reluctant to move on ecology issues if the opposite party has an ecology candidate.
I have no other questions.
This was off the record.
I don't know if this question was asked earlier. We'll have a chance to ask the Alyeska, I presume, but have they requested any construction of tankers?
Atlantic Richfield has ordered 3 tankers at 125,000 tons each. I think Mobile has, some independent tanker owners have. So I believe, I don't know how cancelable the orders are, but they have been ordered. But it would, let me just add, it would also be very much, if you talk about tap line, I should not omit to say that you are equally interested in an early construction of a pipeline, say, to the Midwest, so that you really can have, your interest is to make up for the time lost by a more rapid build-up of production. So I think these two hang together somewhat. But tankers have been ordered, and I think a Seattle to Chicago survey has also been, or is being undertaken.
That apparently is not the problem. If TAPS is authorized, they can start considerably later and still have a link from the Pacific to Chicago completed virtually at the same time as the first deliveries are made at Valdez.
No. Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to ask to pursue the line of questioning that Senator Grove was on. If you gentlemen would care to comment on the effectiveness of the state levying an added tax upon oil produced that goes out via the route that we don't really favor, an overland route.
I don't want to address myself to the question whether you can legally do so or not in interstate commerce. Let's forget that for a moment. But what do you really do? You try to make your oil non-competitive. You may shut it in. With that added, I guess there was a proposal for an added 50 cents You may give great encouragement to Canadian oil exploration and development. As a matter of fact, the Canadian pipeline has an implication for encouraging competing Canadian oil anyhow, of course. You realize that if all of a sudden the Canadians get a huge transport facility through oil-prone areas, it will encourage exploration there. If a big oil field is found and you have a higher tax and you are not protected in the minimum quantities, Canadian oil will be even more preferred. I doubt if you do that, if you do introduce this higher tax, that it will do anything else but discourage the companies that have to ultimately make the investment.
You don't think it would encourage them to work harder for the acceptable route?
I think, I don't know whether they're Avis or or Hertz at the moment. But I believe the companies would prefer TAPS as it is now.
I have several questions. I'd like to start back with the first topic, and that is the question of markets. You indicated that the destination for North Slope crude is the West Coast, and yet of the imports from Canada into the United States now, only about a third go to the West Coast, the other two-thirds going to Chicago. If the West Coast is a prime market, why isn't more Canadian crude sent to the West Coast?
There's a pipeline going just to Puget Sound. And that Trans Mountain, that has expanded considerably and has more or less completely supplied all the refineries in that area. To ship from Puget Sound Canadian oil down to San Francisco or Los Angeles would probably not be competitive.
Let me just say that in times of emergency,
Suez Canal crisis,
or even at the present time when tanker rates have gone very, very high, so that the importation of offshore oil is relatively unattractive to companies with limited access to tanker tonnage, they have in fact been moving some Canadian oil down to San Francisco, for example. But this is of short duration and usually limited to the times when their alternatives are less attractive than under normal times.
Would this hold true? I noticed in the oil import question study that they indicated there was substantial Alberta production capability that was shut in. And there's the question of the tar sands, which you mentioned. Will these be affected, or can we assume that with considering the known production capability of Canada, that oil cannot compete to any greater extent than it is now?
Oh, no, you can't assume that. But this oil has moved fundamentally through new pipeline connections into the Midwest. Interprovincial has expanded it to Chicago, where Canadian oil can be sold 35 cents cheaper than U.S. oil.
In the Midwest?
In the Midwest, yes.
But not on the West Coast?
But not if it would go down to Los Angeles with normal tankers. Then it would probably not be able to do so.
It would not be able to do so?
Going, you see, you would have, in order to extend Trans Mountain and then ship it, say, from Puget Sound to San Francisco and or Los Angeles, I don't think that this would be an economic movement as compared with what they could do in Chicago.
All right, so that Canadian crude, as far as we know of the supplies now, is destined for the Midwest. You don't anticipate any additional to the West Coast?
Not really. The Atlantic Refining Company, as you may have seen, has started or is planning to build another 100,000 barrel a day refinery in Puget Sound. This was, in my judgment, most likely for Alaskan oil. If there should be only a Canadian pipeline to the Midwest, it is not inconceivable that will be supplied with Canadian oil.
Well, if the Canadians are presently supplying all that they can of the Puget Sound area, 100,000 is only a small amount of even 600,000 of the 2 million ultimate capacity, then almost all of the North Slope oil must be destined for California rather than Puget Sound.
That's right.
As far as District 5 is concerned.
I would assume that Trans Mountain, being a facility in existence, owned partly by refining companies, I think, would continue to be used and provide most of the existing Puget Sound capacities except the new refinery. because there the alternative would have been an expansion or looping of Trans Mountain, which wouldn't be worthwhile against Alaskan oil, owned by Atlantic. Owned by Atlantic makes a difference, whereas if Atlantic would get oil from Canada, it would have to purchase prorationed oil, oil which is produced by others.
Right. You indicated that about the Seattle to Chicago pipeline. I thought that about a month ago, an official of Gulf, who I didn't know was participating, had announced that they were abandoning plans at this time on that line. That was what was reported in Alaska papers. I don't know.
I haven't seen it, but it could be related to the delay in TAPS. It mentions that if TAPS gets going, there's time enough to make provisions for the Midwest.
All right. You also indicated that at the present time, there's a line, the Trans Mountain line from Edmonton to Puget Sound. There's also the interprovincial line from Edmonton to the Chicago and on to the eastern United States. Wouldn't it be easier, or wouldn't the cost be cheaper from Edmonton to Seattle for the Alaska crude than it would from Seattle to Chicago?
Yes, but Edmonton, don't forget, the Puget Sound area is covered already with the Trans Mountain line, which is 230,000 barrels a day. And if you do go to Edmonton, you probably want to go to the largest possible market for Alaskan oil first, which is Chicago. It's possible that you will do both, that the companies will do both. My guess is they'll have their handful in going to Chicago.
You indicated that if additional reserves on the North Slope were found, that a line to Chicago might be more feasible in terms of economics than it is now. What do you view as the possibilities of development in Naval Petroleum Reserve number 4, which the oil import question indicates they have recoverable reserves, at least according to some estimates, as great as Prudhoe Bay?
Yeah, I know the Harvard economists who wrote the report. They know as little about the reserves in the Naval Reserve area as I do. That's damn little.
I
don't know whom they quote. Up to now, 100 million barrels a day has been proven in the Naval Reserves.
Which is not Pluto.
No. Hundred million barrels.
Yes.
100 million.
They refer in Table J to 4 different estimates. The United States Geological Survey of 1969, which estimated recoverable reserves of 9.66 billion barrels, and that was based on a 25% of total estimated reserves.
I like the six, the last six.
The Arctic Institute of North America in 69 estimated 4.49 recoverable reserves. And Hendricks, I assume that's who you're referring to, from the Arctic Institute of North America. And Category 1 indicated 25.50, and in Category 2, 8.50.
But this is all, it's made on the basis of geological and seismic information, and anybody in the industry will tell you how many dry holes have been drilled on the basis of geologic and seismic.
You know,
I mean, there may be a lot of reserves there.
And there are bound to be, a lot of reserves, but...
All right, let me ask this. The justification behind the Interior Department impact statement was that we're going to be some 5 million barrels a day short. Now, this doesn't coincide with some other public figures, but that's their basis, that we need the domestic production now. Do you foresee, in light of that being the rationale for going the TAPS route, any effort being made for production from NPR4?
I believe, there will be great resistance to give up naval reserves. Same applied to Elk Hills and I think the Navy will probably say this is what we want to hold on to, not use it up during periods of peace, so to speak. And I doubt it that this will be opened up. There are enough structures and enough good areas in Alaska, offshore, onshore, before the Navy would open up that reserve. I doubt it. But
what is the reserve, the Canadian reserve picture at this time? Canada actually is a consumes more oil than it produces. Is that correct?
Canada
it consumes twice as much oil as it produces.
Yeah, but it exports at least as much as it imports. You see, this comes back to what I said before: buy cheap and sell dear. They buy cheap from abroad and sell dear at a high price to the U.S. But they are in balance, as more than in balance, as far as their domestic demand is concerned.
Canadian reserves today probably are somewhat less than the reserves of Prudhoe. Their known reserves are on the order of 10 billion barrels.
You're talking about in Canada
all
at this
Canada,
time?
All of Canadian reserves, yes. That's
all right. And so they have an estimated capacity at their present rate of production of something like 7 or 8 years in.
No more. More than that.
Well, they're producing what?
You know, at 1.5 million barrels a day, what is it? 1 million barrels a day, they would have 30 years reserves.
At a million?
Yeah, they're producing a little over a million barrels a day.
No.
That's just the convention.
The tar sand is, of course, enorm in size and enorm in expense. Sun Oil, up to now, has lost a lot of money in the tar sand, but they continue expending it. When we talk about tar sand, we talk about maybe 100 billion barrels or something like that. I don't know whether in recoverable, economically recoverable terms, but very large.
All right. What do you view as the ability of North Slope crude to compete with Canadian crude in U.S. markets?
No, for a moment assume there will be a Canadian pipeline, that will be a very interesting problem, because Canadian crude has been priced 35 cents below U.S. crude, say, in the Chicago market, or for that matter, in the Puget Sound market. But there were quantitative limitations on the amount of crude that could be imported from Canada. So this price differential was possible to maintain. If there had been unlimited imports from Canada, you would have assumed that U.S. prices would have been reduced by that amount, or Canadian crude would have expanded its market outlets. If you have a commingled Alaskan and Canadian crude stream going through interprovincial, it's hard for me to imagine that your crude would come out 35 cents higher than the Canadian crude would come out of that line. And by that time, we would also have very substantial quantities. My guess is that at that time, the Canadian crude will probably go up to the U.S., general U.S. level, if the quantities are very substantial, if the combined quantities are very substantial. There is a possibility that you will have to go down to the Canadian level and affect the U.S. price level. It's anybody's guess. In both instances, by the way, certain consequences occur. If your crude price has to match the Canadian level, you lose a substantial amount of money. And the U.S. consumer benefits thereby. If Canadian crude goes up to the U.S. level, together with your own stream, that will be a great encouragement for Canadian exploration and development. So you have, from your point of view, Canada is really a competitor. This is perhaps an important point. From your point of view, Canadian oil is a competitor. The Canadian pipeline is a competing project. From a broad federal point of view, Canadian oil is a safe oil, perhaps not quite as safe, but nearly as safe as Alaskan oil, and a most desirable product to have. You see, I believe the lower 48 wouldn't look at Canada versus Alaska in the same competitive terms as you do.
All right. If that's the case, then what lever does the state have in terms of ensuring the Alaska route versus the Canadian route? I mean, it almost gets to the point where U.S. policy would encourage development of Canadian and Alaskan reserves equally. I could see.
Let me put it this way. If at the moment the environmental agency would say the Canadian route is much safer, but means 2 years delay in completion as compared with TAPS, I think the federal decision would probably go for Canada.
What can the state do to prevent this?
I don't want to suggest secession.
It's occurred to
someone. But there's very little, I believe. You certainly can't, I think you certainly have a case for being involved in the Canadian negotiations, in the Canadian arrangements.
We have a case for being involved in
the. In terms of as it affects your total welfare of the state, you certainly have a case in terms of being also owner of royalty oil. You might be a potential shipper, same as ARCO, the same as Humble, the same as BP. You might wish to sell your royalty oil. You have the right to any U.S. refiner. So why should you not be asked what are the terms and conditions, what are the tariffs, what are the minimum throughput commitments, will my royalty oil, I figure on 2 million barrels a day production, my royalty oil would be 250,000 barrels a day. Will I be cut back because of a new Canadian discovery? This is where I believe you have rights as owner of oil. What rights you have as a state, I think you better ask your Attorney General, I don't know. I can see rights as an owner of the oil. Your 12.5% shouldn't just be ignored as a potential throughput through this line.
I take it that in terms of our relations with Canada, that a big factor as far as Canadian dealings is the import question. And so I'm curious, you've indicated that the Canadians would insist on certain things if the line goes through Canada.
There's no doubt about it.
All right. But what position are they in to insist on those things when they're so dependent on selling oil in the United States? I mean, doesn't the United States, vis-a-vis Canada, have the upper hand?
No, really, not in that sense. If we need Canadian oil very much indeed, too. And we are very interested in maintaining a good oil relationship and good overall relationship with Canada. And they know it and we know it. And if we would cut off Canadian oil now because of conflicts along certain commercial lines, I don't think the threat would even be taken as serious.
Well, it's not a question of cutting them off, but keeping them at present limit.
Yes, but you know, with Mr. Ruckelhaus and the various other people coming in, having said that probably a pipeline through Alaska is a very dangerous thing and a pipeline through Canada may be a very desirable thing, they have increased the Canadian bargaining position immensely.
This is the key thing to the change, I think, in the balance of interest which has taken place. The Mackenzie Valley route is not a new idea. I mean, this was considered from the first time that there was a discovery on Prudhoe Bay. And a certain amount of at least preliminary research was done into it. And the decision, at least on the part of the companies, to take the Alaskan route was based upon the way in which they balanced their interests. And the Canadian government early on would have liked to have had the Mackenzie Valley route, but didn't think that they had much ability, leverage to intervene. Although they did, as a matter of fact, talk to all of the companies concerned very early in the game.
And perhaps
but the uncertainty which has since been intruded into the entire thing and the delays suddenly have changed the, call it what you will, the balance or the betting odds or whatever the case may be.
And Canada comes here and says, we offer you a favor. We make our country available as a corridor. And for that, we want certain rights.
Realistically, in answer to the question which keeps cropping up so often, what can Alaska do? And I think part of the answer is what really are the balances of considerations in all directions. For example, if it were to be proven that it's almost impossible to meet reasonable criteria on an Alaskan route, and you just swimmingly go through Canada, there's probably very little that you can do. But I do think under the present circumstances, the one thing that Alaska can do as a state, which means through their executive and their representatives in Washington, is to try to get all of the uncertainties spoken to as quickly as possible. Because the longer the thing drags on, the more difficult it's going to be to get started, and the greater opportunity, almost compulsion, it is to pursue the Canadian route.
Of course, trying to find out what those uncertainties are is like trying to capture an eel, you know.
But eels have been captured.
But, I mean, one after the other seems to creep up. All of a sudden, the Department, Army Department of Engineers comes up with new problems under a law of 1898, which nobody seemed to have considered. You see,
I didn't want to interrupt from you, too. I'll just ask a question. Okay. What impact do you think this would have on influencing the Canadian route, the Valley's route, if the state took a position in law right now, through legislative action approved by the governor, that it refused to let the pipeline companies go across certain state lands into Canada? Just said, if that's the way you want to go, we won't let you do it. We have some sovereign rights. Would that be the kind of influence that might turn off this deal that's cooking in Canada?
Could I ask you, ask you a question first? Are you absolutely sure that TAP line in the final analysis is a line that will not have impossible risks for Alaska? I mean, if you were absolutely sure, if the questions that have been raised have been reasonably resolved, maybe that would be the way to force it, if it were constitutionally possible. But you don't want to preclude Canada as long as you're not 100% certain that TAP line is really, without being a technician, I'm sure it can be resolved, but would I make the alternative impossible or put myself into a position that I have to restore?
It seems to me that overall there are two questions, and maybe we don't have the perspective in Alaska. One, what you've indicated that you think it would be a real mistake if the reserves and the North Slope were not developed and somewhat quickly. How prevalent is that feeling? You also indicated that depending on who the candidate of the opposite party is, there may be a delay on the granting of the TAPS permit. It seems to me, is the question, how much force is there behind the movement of some development? It seems to me this is a question over which the state has really very little control. But what is the overall push for development?
I believe you can safely assume that there's general agreement that this oil should be produced and developed. I also believe there is a genuine feeling that the information that has been supplied up to now and or translated into an impact statement by the Interior was not quite adequate. I believe I would grant complete integrity to these point of views of the various people who have raised it. I also would feel that there may be a general feeling that whether TAP line and or Canadian line is ready a year earlier or a year later does not really in the overall picture matter too much, even though it may matter a great deal to Alaska and is terribly expensive, mind you, to the companies concerned. But I would say that time element is not one of utmost urgency in the mind of the policymaking people. As fast as possible, but not irresponsibly fast. And the question of responsibility is defined somewhat differently by the various agencies. Interior was very keen to have it done fast. The first time they came out with a statement, they had no impact statement. And that was apparently a clear violation of the Environmental Act, which allowed an injunction to be issued against it, which you still have to get rid of. So you cannot count that the same sense of urgency exists in the Defense Department even as it exists here, in terms of getting it out a year earlier, 2 years earlier.
Well, was it correct that as to that overall question, aside from the exact routes over which the state may, as Senator Thomas indicates, have considerable control, that as to this general question, the speed with which whatever development is going to occur does take place, that we have considerably less control over that?
You may have there at least some leverage with the companies where the interest of having it done fast is exactly the same as yours. Because the companies have tied up a hell of a lot of money there, and for them to come out a year earlier with production, or 2 years earlier with production, means a tremendous amount of money.
What is the indicate? You indicated that a gas pipeline would have to go through Canada, at least at the present state of the technology. What is the indication, what have you seen in terms of the gas reserves on the North Slope, and what does that mean? I mean, we can compute 2 million barrels a day of production with the energy requirements of the United States now or in 75 or 80, but what do the reserves hold in terms of energy requirements?
I know very little about that. I don't know whether you have, but I'm sure you're Alaskan mineral.
Well, I've seen and heard figures on what the potential reserves of solution gas are on Prudhoe. Probably enough to support several billion cubic feet a day of movement into the United States, but a pipeline to be economic would probably have to be somewhat larger than that.
Neighborhood of what?
3 billion cubic feet a day if it's a 48-inch pipeline. But presumably out of the reserves of Prudhoe and some of the gas fields which have been discovered or identified on the North Slope, you could support a movement of 3 billion cubic feet a day. Now that's, for example, that's the equivalent of all of the applications for the importation of liquefied natural gas into the East Coast, putting them all together. They don't come to quite 3 billion cubic feet a day. That's the equivalent of what might be the amount of gas out of the Arctic Islands, for example, for one pipeline. But in terms of percentages of, if we talked about a potential gap in U.S. gas requirements in 1980, it might be 10% of the whole gap out of the North Slope.
That might be filled.
Yeah, filled by North Slope gas in the first instance.
Of course, what we will see is we will see the gas prices increase, more exploration, hopefully successful, and a slowdown of utilization. So this is a gap more or less subject to the contraction if and when prices go up, and as a result demand will come down, expansion of demand will come down, and new sources will be found.
What about the markets for the gas? What are the primary markets? Is the Midwest?
Well, there you would have the gas pipelines servicing and interconnected.
The West Coast, the East Coast?
Yes, you would have a very large interconnection.
Because of the lack of supply, you can...
Well, there's no
problem. It's a seller's market as far as gas is
concerned. Yeah.
On the market, what are the possibilities of selling North Slope gas in Japan?
You would have to pipe it through Valdez, to Valdez, which is an expensive pipeline. You would then have to liquefy it, and you probably would get a very uneconomic netback on it.
How about for crude?
Equally. I noticed people suggested it. Again, you could, if you wanted to, think of shipping North Slope crude to Japan in return for an import license from a nearby source. But the federal government would look, I'm sure, with very great reluctance to a scheme like that, because it would do nothing for U.S. security. It would not, Alaskan oil would not be available in an emergency for the U.S. And I think this is a non-starter as a scheme.
Not only that, outside of the United States, whether it's the West Coast or the Midwest, represents a virtual guaranteed market for Alaskan crude oil. Japan is a competitive market. The odds are, no matter what happens, that it has lower value in Japan than in the United States, but worse, more importantly, it hits up against a variable price in Japan. That is to say, other countries and companies producing in other countries look upon the Japanese market as a place in which they can dispose of very, very large reserves, much larger than crude oil. And if you have to compete with Middle East oil in Japan, it's a heck of a place to...
No, it would only be possible if it's an exchange deal. In any case, and that would require federal approval. I just believe it's not on. I could never understand even why the Japanese invested in Canada, because that oil would not be available to them, I'm sure, in an emergency. The Canadians would keep it.
Right. Mr. Chairman, to get back to your question a few moments ago about the... you mentioned buying cheap and selling dear with regard to Canada and its relationship with the United States on the oil situation. If the U.S. supply of offshore oil were cut off in time of crises, so wouldn't Canada's? And isn't Canada in a situation to where it can actually only supply that amount of crude which it would consume if its offshore supply were cut?
Yes, except it wouldn't have the transport facilities to bring it to eastern Canada where it is needed. You know, there are no pipeline facilities going beyond Toronto to the Montreal area and or to the Newfoundland area where there are large new refining capacities. They would have to be supplied from offshore. And
well, excuse me, go ahead.
So Canadian oil could not physically go there.
But this goes to the question of Canadian oil competing with Alaskan crude in the case of a crisis that was raised, I think, by both of you.
What we were afraid of is that the Canadians say, in a crisis, where they couldn't supply the eastern refineries, would go to the U.S. and say, we supply you with 1 million barrels a day, you better make provisions to supply us from Texas or Louisiana with 500,000 barrels a day by tankers.
We did that in effect in November, December of 1956 and January, February, March of 57, in the first closure of the Suez Canal. A large proportion of the crude oil that went into eastern Canadian refineries came by tanker from the U.S. Gulf. At that time, we had surplus producing capacity, and we in Venezuela could both expand.
But of course, we in this case really meant the companies operating the refineries on the eastern part of Canada, who also are quite interested in maintaining Canada as an import market, didn't want to give arguments to those Canadians who wanted to have a pipeline going there by having, during a crisis, that area short of oil. So the companies and the Canadian interest was parallel to be sure that Eastern Canada was supplied during a crisis, and the surplus capacity was there.
I think we're going to take a break now until 8 o'clock this evening. We'll resume here at 8 o'clock. Each member of the committee asked questions so far. I think for a few minutes we might ask that other members of the legislature ask questions, and then we'll go back to committee questions. Are there any members of the legislature here that have questions that they want to ask this time? Okay, back to questions from the committee. Marty?
Hope I can phrase it right. At what point in time, if the pipeline is not built, either through TAPS or Canada, at what point in time will there have to be a change in the import quotas to satisfy the crude requirements, which will affect, possibly a long period of time, the domestic crude fulfillments? In other words, if we don't have anything going for 9 years, will there be such a change in the import quotas where you'll have they tend to have a permanent depression in domestic crude prices, which would affect the Alaska prices?
If nothing is done here about the North Slope, and if the trend in the 48, lower 48 states, as far as production is concerned, remains the same as of now, namely slow decrease, really. I would say that from perhaps 77 onwards, we would have an ever increasing import quota, which would only be possible to fill by imports from the Middle East and North Africa. That means we may have, I can give you perhaps some exact figures, exact is a wrong word, by 1980 we would have import requirements from offshore sources without the North Slope, if the North Slope would not be available, of perhaps 6 million barrels a day out of total crude requirements of, that would be nearly 40% of our total crude requirements.
In addition to which there would be fuel oil imports. We're just talking about
crude requirements. The fuel oil imports would come from Venezuela, I assume, as before. most of them anyhow. But well, as far as crude oil is concerned, we would be an importer in the United States of perhaps 40%. 20% may well be coming, 20-25% from Middle East and North Africa, which, say, we would consider particularly unsafe sources. The remaining 15% or so from of our demand, crude demand from Canada and other Western Hemisphere. Now, as you